You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 19th of November 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, French prosecutors confirm that the principal plotter of Friday night's massacre in Paris was killed during a police raid yesterday. French politicians, meanwhile, extend the state of emergency. We'll look at what happens next. Also ahead, the latest APEC summit winds down in Manila, adding a joint declaration to the global chorus of condemnation of terror. Is there a one-size-fits-all worldwide approach to extremism? We'll also look at Iran's steps to comply with the nuclear deal and its concurrent steps to make life even harder for journalists and artists, and see if we can figure out who is winning the struggle for the Islamic Republic's soul. And as the president of Kazakhstan suggests that everybody but him should retire sooner, we'll ask, how old is too old to run a country, and how long is too long? That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Michael Binion, Foreign Affairs Specialist for The Times here in London, and Ramita Navai, journalist and author, most recently of City of Lies, Love, Sex, Death, and The Search for Truth in Tehran. Welcome both. We are going to start tonight in Paris, where earlier today authorities confirmed that among those killed by a raid by police on a Saint-Denis apartment yesterday was Abdelhamid Abaoud, believed to be the principal author of Friday night's massacre in Paris, which left 129 people dead. Mr. Abaoud was a 28-year-old Belgian known to have spent time in Syria on at least two visits, and it has emerged now implicated in several previously thwarted attacks. Michael, first of all, as we've learnt, he had left Belgium to go to Syria at least twice. No EU states had managed to flag his return into the EU. At the very real risk of tempting fate, does this suggest that perhaps laws and the enforcement thereof are not sufficiently stringent?
Absolutely, but it also suggests that the particular way of catching people, the old-fashioned way, is to stop them at borders. And the fact that there are no border controls within Europe means that you only have to fool the authorities once to get into Greece, say, and then you're home and free and you can travel right across Europe. The catch should be intelligence. There should be immediate alerting of people right across Europe if there's a suspicion that a terrorist is travelling. But in fact, there's no intelligence alert almost at any time.
It is extraordinary, especially when the other thing that we have learnt, Ramita, is that it's not like Mr. Abaoud had been lurking in the shadows. He had he hadn't even been hiding in plain sight. He'd actually even been profiled in Islamic State's magazine, Dabiq, boasting about travelling undetected around Europe. I mean, we do have to grant that, you know, I think the intelligence agencies can't be everywhere and sort of concede that we learn more about their failures than their successes, but somebody should have known where this bloke was.
Yes, and I think this shows that French and Belgian intelligence services have not been doing a very good job at all. I think it's extraordinary that he had he was subject of an international and European arrest warrant, charged in Belgium in absentia for 20 years for terrorism recruitment. So intelligence had his photo, and in fact he boasted that he was stopped at a border by an official who, according to him, looked at a screen, at a photo, looked at him and didn't recognise the likeness. And he, as you said, he's been boasting about this in the Islamic State propaganda magazine, but also in videos. I don't know if either of you have seen videos of him, but he's boasting of recruiting these videos and of travelling between Europe and Syria.
Is there a problem? I mean, Michael, as Ramita points out, it does suggest that perhaps Belgian and French intelligence services need to unclog whatever lines of communication they may have. But is there a problem here in that our intelligence services still think of themselves, not unreasonably, I guess, as national bodies with a remit that stops at the borders of their country, whereas, thanks to the Schengen Agreement in particular, we have people like this chap wandering at will all over the continent?
That's exactly the case, yes. Intelligence services do officially cooperate, but they provide the minimum of intelligence. When they think somebody is moving across the border, they will sometimes get in touch, but they don't give the background to why they have a suspicion. They don't give the detail. They don't give, really, the necessary material to be able to catch somebody. And particularly, this is the case with Belgium and France. I have to say, this is one of the most porous borders for terrorists that exists in Europe, and there's been constant travelling backwards and forwards of people across from Belgium. Belgian intelligence, I have to say, is not the best. France has a better record, but Belgium has a pretty poor record of keeping track on people living in this deprived suburb of Brussels.
France is now speaking of making some sort of changes to the Schengen agreement. They haven't been too specific about what yet. I mean, it is, Ramita, one of those obvious examples of that balance between security and liberty. Obviously, in many respects, Schengen is immensely convenient. It does save you an awful lot of time faffing around, especially if you're crossing between reasonably small countries. But as we have been learning, it's made life fairly easy for people for whom we would probably prefer life to be rather more difficult. Should it be suspended or abandoned?
I think absolutely not. I think it's one of the principles of the European Union. I think at this point it is important to remember that so far of all the terrorists identified, they're all homegrown. None of them are Syrians. They're French-born and they're Belgian-born. There's one foreigner. We don't know where he's from. He was travelling on a fake passport, Syrian passport. That doesn't mean that he's Syrian. However, you're right. It's an argument because should it be the threat of our security?
Michael, we're still sort of witnessing the diplomatic and political shakeout of Friday night's massacre in Paris. One thing that appears definite to occur is that François Hollande will travel to Moscow next week to meet Vladimir Putin. There's no formal alliance yet between France and Russia in terms of dealing with Islamic State. They both seem now, for quite obvious reasons, the two countries most invested in it. Are we likely to see some sort of actual formal arrangement between the two?
I don't think a formal arrangement. This is an alliance of convenience, and it's one that is supremely useful to Putin. He is the opportunist, if ever there was, who's risked everything by sending planes over to Syria because he could have got sucked into an intractable civil war and the Russian people could have turned against him. He could also have widened the Gulf for the West. But then two things happened, the shooting down of a Russian plane and the attacks in Paris, and suddenly he saw the chance to get back into the tent. And that's exactly what he's done. And he's playing it for all it's worth. He is dropping bombs on ISIS. And most other European countries argue, well, actually, that's the priority at the moment. Going on about Ukraine is not the main thing we need to do. I think, in fact, it will actually probably open a general dialogue with Russia, which may actually make it easier to find some kind of compromise or face-saving formula in Ukraine. But at the moment, that's been set aside, and there is coordinated action going on.
And just before we move on, or move off the subject at least, of the unlamented Abdelhamid Abaoud, I did want to raise with you both one, I guess, point of presentation. I think I described him in the introduction tonight as the author of the attacks on Paris. There's been a certain amount of chatter about whether, in describing him as a ringleader or a mastermind, we are perhaps extending him more kudos than he is due. Ramita, do you think there's anything in that, or is this just people now at that overthinking at point?
I think the most interesting thing about him isn't structurally where he sat in Islamic State, but it's how was he radicalised and what was his radicalisation like? He doesn't strike me as a man who joined ISIS for religious reasons, and this is where it gets interesting. If you've heard interviews with his family, they say, you know, he's a thug. He was done for robbery. His sister says he never went to mosque. He liked drugs, booze, and women.
It's amazing how common that is, isn't it? But this turns out to be the profile.
Yes, and it doesn't seem that it was religion. It was power. It was violence. So, you know, ISIS seemed to have kind of two-pronged recruitment strategy here. They're preying on the vulnerable, but also preying on boys that want to go and fight and want war and glory.
I rather suspect that's a fairly untrumpable analysis. But Michael, again, just in terms of nomenclature, I mean, there's obviously any number of names one could think of to apply to Abdelhamid Abaoud and those of his ilk. But really, for purposes of discussing him, do we do him a favour if we apply to him words like ringleader or mastermind?
Well, I would prefer ringleader to mastermind. Mastermind suggests a rather cool, intellectual, calculating thing. Ringleader is just the top thug among thugs, and that's what he was. And I agree absolutely with Ramita. This seems to be a man who was only interested in violence. And there was this moment of transition where he suddenly saw that's his way to personal fame and glory. And this is exactly what you find in prison, of course. A number of people who've got very low self-esteem because they've been in prison, because society more or less said that you're pretty useless, you're not measuring up. They suddenly find a way to redeem themselves by moving into a completely different sphere and saying, actually, I'm now fighting on behalf of a bigger cause. And that's probably the myth that he convinced himself of.
Well, let's move on now, because among the many stories which have been somewhat overlooked as the world has been transfixed by Paris has been the APEC summit in Manila. This ended today with a joint declaration of resolve against terrorism, which may be the one thing that APEC's 21 members presently agree on. The communique said that under the shadow cast by terrorist attacks in Paris, Beirut, and against Russian aircraft over the Sinai and elsewhere, we strongly condemn all acts, methods, practices of terrorism in all their forms and manifestations. Very careful there to cover absolutely every imaginable base. Michael, first of all, a good many of those members of APEC have fairly substantial experience of terrorism and indeed Islamist terrorism. Have they dealt with it notably differently to how Europe or the West might have?
The one we haven't really looked at in much detail is China, where they have a very large, disaffected minority in the west of China, and they are Uyghurs, they are Muslim Chinese, Chinese citizenship, but not ethnic Han race, and they have been disaffected for some long time and have become steadily more radicalized. The Chinese are terrified that this virus of radicalization will jump from the Middle East right into the middle of the Uyghur community, and it does seem to have done something rather like that. And the Chinese have been, without any apology, absolutely repressive in the way they've tackled it. They've simply gone up, rounded people up, thrown them into prison. No attempts at hearts and minds, really.
And done so with an absolute minimum of scrutiny from a free media, because there isn't one.
Well, indeed. I mean, there's hardly anyone who's visited there. Those that have haven't found it very easy to get to talk to the local population about their feelings about all this. Things have come out saying how they feel that because of the heavy-handed approach, there is a lot more sympathy for the terrorists than there would have been had the Chinese approached it more subtly.
Ramita, you spoke there earlier of the character, or what we've learnt of the alleged ringleader, if that's what we're going to call him, of the massacres in Paris. And obviously what you're describing there is not a local phenomenon of, you know, young, disaffected, possibly somewhat thick young men. Is it possible to look at Islamist insurgencies from, I guess, West Africa to Southeast Asia and see them all as essentially part of the same problem? Or is it a localized thing that's different everywhere it is?
Localized that's different everywhere it is, I think. But, I mean, recruitment methods are the same. They were the same with Al-Qaeda. They were the same with the Janjaweed, with Al-Shabaab. If you look at how they recruit, it's always preying on the vulnerable. Propaganda is always the same. So, yes and yes.
It's a sort of franchise in a way, isn't it? I mean, you've got the overall idea.
Yes, exactly.
And you sign up to it. And then you say, well, I'm part of it. I mean, they don't appoint you. They don't direct this cell to be set up. Well, they can, but usually they wait for somebody to approach and say, we are with you. You know, we declare that we are part of this whole thing. And then you get the benefits of getting kind of inspired with video and stuff that they send out to you, and you use that for your recruitment and you sign on.
Yeah.
I mean, Boko Haram, this started locally and now they've said they're part of this global phenomenon.
And if you look at Albanians, so there have been a few Albanians who have made it to kind of top command ISIS structure. There's certainly Abu al-Albani. And you're right, it is localized. So in a way, it's ethnic Albanian troubles, Albanians feeling disenfranchised, feeling persecuted, joining up forces with Islamic State. And I think this happens all over.
One deeply unhappy thought I wanted to put to you was a Pew poll released this week. I'm not sure if you saw it. It surveyed global attitudes to Islamic State. Perhaps unsurprisingly, they registered 100% disapproval in Lebanon, not terribly many fans in Jordan or Palestine. But in Indonesia, 4% favourable and 18% undecided. And I'm not sure how you remain undecided at this point. 11% favourable, 25% undecided in Malaysia. How big a worry is that?
Well, let me tell you something that I found out when I was in Lebanon that I thought was extraordinary. I spoke to many Syrians, and we're talking educated, secular Syrians, whose families supported Islamic State for pragmatic reasons. So they believed Islamic State was the only way to beat Assad. And I think in the same way...
My enemy's enemy is, etc.
Well, they swapped and changed. You know, if they thought the FSA in their town was on the winning side, they backed the FSA. If Islamic State seemed to be on the winning side, they backed the Islamic State. But in the same way that... For Malaysians, for Indonesians who are undecided or who maybe are sympathetic, I don't think they're sympathetic to the beheadings and Islamic State ideology for everything it stands for. I think by backing, you know, sympathizing with Islamic State, what they're saying is they're making a bigger statement of Western hypocrisy. That's usually how these kind of sympathizers pan out in the Middle East, when you're faced with kind of more secular, educated people.
I would also say that both those countries are fairly removed from the center of trouble in the Middle East. Yeah. I mean, they both have a tradition of fairly moderate Islam anyway, and they haven't had direct experience. You see, I'm not surprised that Jordan is deeply hostile because of the pilot who was burnt alive. Yeah. Up till that point, Jordan had actually found quite a large number of young people were sort of cheering them on. And then this happened, and the whole country switched around. Now, nothing has happened in Malaysia or Indonesia that has really involved them in the atrocities that Islamic State have committed. So I think that's why you'll get this sort of soft support for them.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, along with Ramita Navai and Michael Binion. Coming up next, steps forwards, backwards and sideways in Iran, and how long is too long to stay in power?
Our ideas-packed Entrepreneur's Guide. The design directory for people who want to build a better home. The style guide for getting to grips with the business of looking good. The soft power survey. The travel top 50. Monocle magazine has a superlative lineup of survey reports and investigations coming your way. And to make sure that you never miss an issue, you just need to do one thing. Become a Monocle subscriber. Not only will you get all of this great journalism, you'll also have free access to our full archive of stories online, receive invites to subscriber events around the world, and be sent a free gift too. Go to monocle.com/subscribe to join us today.
And welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. Still with me are Ramita Navai and Michael Binion. Now, when Iran came to terms with the rest of the world about the future of its nuclear program earlier this year, not even the most optimistic observer expected the way forward to be entirely unhindered. But according to this week's quarterly report by the IAEA, Tehran appears to be doing most of the right things, breaking up 4,500 centrifuges by way of a start. Elsewhere, regrettably, it's business as usual, if not more so, in the shape of a crack down against journalists, writers, artists, and others of what the hardliners regard as the usual suspect. Ramita, are those two phenomena perhaps related? Is this the hardline in Tehran realizing that as long as the world needs them to play nice over their nukes and over Syria, they can pretty much behave as they please?
Yes. The hardliners are posturing, and they're more than posturing now with the crackdown on journalists. But their posturing started, I don't know if you remember, was it about a month ago that they tested a ballistic missile, which was in violation of the UN sanctions? So they're sending out a very strong message, and they're sending out a strong message internally. Of course, this is a real threat to the whole system. You know, the whole regime that's based on Islamic values. Islamic values is the West is evil, you must keep the West out. And of course, we must forget that the Revolutionary Guard have done very well economically with sanctions in place. They don't want Iran to open up to the West.
Michael, the same report has also suggested that Iran's stockpiles of low-enriched uranium have actually increased. Is Iran hedging again, not for the first time? This was their tactic throughout the negotiations.
Well, I think they always have hedged, yes. I mean, that's possible. I think I don't see that the West is particularly concerned about that, because, after all, they have said that Iran can go ahead with nuclear energy and peaceful uses of it, and is allowed to possess nuclear material. But I think the key point is that the moderates, if you can call them that, in other words, those who are in favour of the deal, are probably going to win the argument with the people, but not if the Revolutionary Guard can do anything about it. So I wouldn't be a bit surprised if the Revolutionary Guard is itself pointing out possible violations in order to sabotage the agreement, or is doing all it can to discredit the moderates with the Supreme Leader, who is hedging his bets all the time, because the Revolutionary Guard stand to lose everything, all their power, all their economic clout, all their control, and they will be bypassed, which is what the majority of the population wants.
As you both point out, the Revolutionary Guards have done actually quite all right out of sanctions, both economically, financially, politically, as elements always do under sanctions. Are they perhaps also worried, and I'll ask you this, Ramita, that as the sanctions are lifted and there is a general uptick in prosperity, that might also be answered by a general demand for further freedom? It's often the case that economic prosperity prompts greater demands for political freedom.
Yes, they absolutely are. And of course, this is a statistic that's often trotted out, but 70-80% of the country is below the age of 35. Got a massive young population. They're already worried. With access to the internet and with satellite, things are really changing. There's a sexual awakening that's happening. The fabric of society in Tehran, as the hardliners know it, is changing. And of course, internally, I think with regards to the nuclear issue, it's really interesting that the moderates are desperate to keep the hardliners happy as well. The moderates know that they need to keep the hardliners on side. So while they were negotiating over the nuclear program, the Iranians were very keen to let the hardliners know that the Iranians hadn't capitulated, that actually it was the Americans who'd capitulated. And they reminded the Iranian people that in 2003, the Iranians were on side, the Americans were on side with Israel. So in 2003, the Americans were demanding zero centrifuges and zero enrichment. And of course, it was the Americans that changed their demands, that then came to meet Iran's demands. They came to meet Iran in the middle.
I also want to ask you, Ramita, the crackdown on journalists, which we've talked about, I think I'm right in saying that most, if not all, of the journalists arrested in recent weeks work for outlets which generally support President Hassan Rouhani, the relative moderate in all of this. Is someone trying to tell him something?
This is the internal struggle. This is the internal battle between the hardliners and the so-called reformists. Absolutely. That it's widely thought that is why Siam Aknamazi, an American-Iranian, was arrested about a month ago. He's in prison. Jason Rezaian, the Washington Post journalist, he's a Westerner held the longest in Iran, that it is that the hardliners embarrassing the reformists internationally by this crackdown, by saying, listen, we're the ones in charge. And you know what? They are in charge. The hardliners are in charge of most of parliament, the judiciary, TV, radio, military, security forces, intelligence forces, and that's what they're doing.
This is a final thought from you on this one, Michael. Is there actually, as Iran tries to sort this out within itself, is there a role for the outside world to play, with all due deference to the fact that previous outside attempts to influence affairs in Iran have tended to go about as badly as might be imagined? or is this just something Iran needs to figure out by itself?
Well, I think the role the outside world could play is actually, ironically, the one that is the most insidious and the most effective, and that is to open up Iran as quickly and as profitably as possible for Iran. In other words, do deals, do business deals, free up travel, make it easier for young people to study overseas, open up their horizons, let them see the rest of the world, and that inevitably will fuel the demand for more freedom, a better style of life, the kind of thing that the Revolutionary Guard had hoped they could keep under control. And the more the West engages with Iran, the more this will happen.
Well, we'll look finally tonight at Kazakhstan, whose president, Nursultan Nazarbayev, has floated an idea for ensuring a steady flow of fresh blood into government positions. He wants the civil service retirement age of 63 for men to be more rigorously enforced, and suggested that anyone who has occupied a government post for 25 years should collect their clock and clear off. Now, what with one thing and another, it would be a brave or foolhardy Kazakh who observed that President Nazarbayev himself is 75 and has been in position for precisely that ominous 25 years. Michael, first of all, should President Nazarbayev set an example?
Well, it's hard to say. Yes, I mean, that would be in the ideal world, he should. But he hasn't trained up any successor. There's nobody who would easily fit into his shoes. There's nobody who will have the same clout. I'm not necessarily saying that's a good thing. It's a very bad thing. It shows that he has he holds all the strings in his hand and has no intention of retiring. But at the moment, it doesn't look likely that he will, and probably not many people would like him to.
Ramita, in general, how old is too old to do a job like that? Because this is going to become a question as the American presidential election gets into gear. Hillary Clinton, if she runs and wins, would be the second oldest U.S. president sworn in for the first time. Bernie Sanders, if he runs and wins, though I think that's fairly unlikely, would be actually the oldest. At what point should people start thinking maybe running an entire country is a bit beyond me?
At the point like Mugabe, when you start teetering around and you can't really stand on your legs properly anymore.
Yeah, yeah. He's about 300 years old.
Exactly. And I don't want to lower the tone, but have you seen pictures of our Kazakh?
No.
He looks absolutely remarkable. I would love to know what cream he uses.
Yes.
So I think Hillary is looking pretty good as well.
But don't forget, I mean, some have had a pretty good record. Adenauer, I think, was 73 when he came to power for the first time.
Indeed,
and he
so.
Went on for a long time. And West Germany would never, ever have got off its knees if it hadn't been for him.
If it's not just a question of how old you are when you get the job, is there an issue of like how long you stay in it? Ramita, are the Americans on the right track with term limits? Is 8 years about enough to do a job like that?
I think so. And I think you're right. I think there should be a cutoff point. My uncle's a knee surgeon, and my uncle says that as soon as his hand starts shaking, that's when he realizes yes. that he's no good for the job. So, yeah, we need to put that in place for politicians as well.
And people get bored of the same face. I mean, however good you are, people just feel, oh, we've seen that face. It seems to be 10 years. Nearly all of them do pretty well up to 10 years. Take Margaret Thatcher, for example. It was the final 1 year that where it all went completely wrong. And with Blair, I mean, even in his final year, it started going wrong. And he realised he'd got to get out after 10 years pretty quickly. Otherwise, the thing would go very toxic.
Well, actually, I guess to ask the same question in the other direction, Ramita, have we reached a point... I mean, there is a tendency, I think, and I'm not just saying this as a middle-aged person, but it does appear that, you know, political leaders do get younger and younger. Is that just because they look nicer on television? Are we being, I guess, unfair on potentially great older leaders?
Perhaps. Or are American politicians using more and more Botox, as is being often claimed? And I think they are. Is it Putin? I mean, Putin has had... facelift. How many facelifts has he had? He's has regular injections of Botox. I think they're very aware that you can no longer look like an old 90-year-old Mugabe.
I mean, the idea that there are people younger than myself actually running countries is still something that can cause me to wake screaming in the night from time to time. Michael, final thought from you from this. Should we be actually allowing older people to remain in politics longer, or indeed in positions anywhere in the public service, in the military, in the civil service? You know, these are decades of experience we're now throwing away, and you know, mid-50s to mid-60s is no longer as old as it once was.
No, it isn't, and I think those people do have a lot to offer. Of course, it depends on the person, and the difficulty is framing a law that makes it possible to keep on some people who are really good while telling others it's time to go. I mean, there's some people in their mid-70s and you've got one approaching there talking to you right now. as long as you can do the job, that's what matters.
Well, we shall leave it on that note and on the observation of H.L. Mencken that the natural tendency of any government is to grow steadily worse. Ramita Navai and Michael Binion, thank you very much for joining us here at Midori House. That is all for today's episode. It was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Jamie Waters. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. Sophie Grove is in next with Monocle's international playlist for the next half hour. Andrew Tuck follows her at 1900 with The Urbanist. I'm back with the Monocle Daily with Emma Nelson at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow at 1800, but for this edition, it's goodbye. Thanks for listening.